I am concerned that the escalation in violence could have horrific consequences for civilians.
The United Nations has a new problem in Myanmar. It's Thursday, July 8th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman. Also ahead, the United States completes withdrawing more than 90% of its forces from Afghanistan. Millions of U.S. COVID vaccine donations for more countries. U.S. military trash means money for some Afghans. The longest married presidential couple in the United States history celebrates. And you'll take a ride with biker chicks in Los Angeles. It's all on today's VOA Asia. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Michelle Bachelet, warns Myanmar could plunge into war as despair among the civilian population rises in the wake of the military coup. The High Commissioner's report is being discussed as part of a special interactive dialogue on Myanmar at the UN Human Rights Council. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
More than 5 months have passed since Myanmar's military leaders derailed the country's fragile democracy. UN Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet says what began as a coup by the Myanmar military has rapidly morphed into an attack against the civilian population. She says nearly 900 people have been killed and some 200,000 forced to flee from increasingly violent military raids on neighborhoods and villages. She warns the widespread and systematic assaults against civilians risk sparking a broader civil war. She says despair is rising.
Some people in many parts of Myanmar have taken up arms and formed self-protection groups. These newly formed armed opposition groups have launched attacks in several locations to which the security forces have responded with disproportionate force. I am concerned that this escalation in violence could have horrific consequences for civilians.
Bachelet notes the coup has exacerbated several long-running conflicts in Myanmar's borderlands. She says fighting has resumed in Kachin, Kayin, and northern Shan states. She adds Chin and Kayas states, which have been largely peaceful in recent years, have taken up arms again. The High Commissioner warns Myanmar's political crisis has evolved into a multidimensional human rights catastrophe. This, she says, is causing inestimable suffering for the population and is devastating prospects for sustainable development. Bachelet is calling on the international community to pressure the military to stop attacking its people and to return the country to democracy. She notes 10 leaders of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, known as ASEAN, drew up a possible roadmap for addressing the crisis in Myanmar when they met in late April.
ASEAN's 5-point consensus is an important starting point for the way forward. But I urge swift action to advance this process before the human rights situation in the country deteriorates further. This should be reinforced by Security Council action. I urge all states to act immediately to give effect to the General Assembly's call to prevent the flow of arms into Myanmar.
Myanmar is not participating in this debate because the United Nations Credentials Committee has not yet decided who is the legitimate government and should hold the UN seat. The choice is between the deposed democratically elected government or Myanmar's ruling military junta, who seized power in a coup d'etat. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Dozens of people protesting against the military takeover of Myanmar held a flash mob rally on Wednesday in Yangon, the country's largest city. Demonstrators used smoke bombs to provide a colorful atmosphere to the brief rally as they chanted anti-military slogans while flashing the three-fingered protest salute. Wednesday's rally coincided with the 59th anniversary of a violent crackdown on university students by the Burmese military regime that staged the coup in 1962. Resistance to military rule continues 5 months after civilian leader Aung San Suu Kyi was removed from power on February 1st. According to the Assistance Association for Political Prisoners, more than 890 people have been killed since the military takeover. We invite you to read more on our top story by following our Twitter stream at VOA Asia. We're also on Facebook, VOA Asia, and the voanews.com website. These are among the top Asia headlines you'll find right now at voanews.com. a massive soil mound on slope seen as worsening Japan mudslide. Japan considers a ban on Olympic spectators and prepares a state of emergency for Tokyo. India's health minister quits as Modi readies cabinet reshuffle. Thailand's popular resort island, Phuket, reports its first COVID-19 case from overseas on Wednesday. China urges the U.S. to review Chinese students' visa applications denied under Trump-era rules. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia, Instagram, Twitter, and on the voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. According to information released by the U.S. Central Command this week, the United States has completed withdrawing more than 90% of its forces from Afghanistan. Joining us with details about the U.S. troop drawdown is VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb. She spoke with VOA's Steve Miller.
This isn't really surprising if you think about it. The largest U.S. base, Bagram Airfield, which has served for nearly two decades as the center of the U.S. fight to remove Taliban forces from power and also take down the al-Qaeda terrorists responsible for killing Americans, that base was handed over just a few days ago. And so once that base was handed over, the expectation was that that was the big bulk of this withdrawal. There are still some concentrated forces in Kabul. The U.S. is going to be ultimately transitioning from where it is now to just providing security for the embassy. And then also, until there is a solution for the airport, they're going to be helping out the Turks provide security for the airport in Kabul as well. So not a big shocker, but it is good to know that they are that close to being complete. There is a caveat to that, though, let me tell you, because just because they're 90% complete does not mean that you're going to be seeing the U.S. saying that they're finished in the next few days. We asked that to several U.S. officials, and they say that the expectation now is that the U.S. will be done with their withdrawal by August.
Carla, I wanted to ask you about Bagram Air Base, because over the weekend, there was some reporting that the new Afghan commander of the air base was not aware that the United States was withdrawing. Has the Pentagon made any comments about that particular situation?
Yes. Yeah, so before the U.S. Independence Day holiday, VOA was able to confirm. We were actually one of the first to confirm shortly after the Associated Press that the U.S. had handed over Bagram to Afghan forces. We announced it even before the Afghan ministry, I think, had put it out on Twitter. But over the last several days, we realized that it wasn't as easy as a handover as we initially expected it to be. And I asked Pentagon Press Secretary John Kirby about that today. And he told me, when I asked, was this not a huge oversight? He goes, well, I can't tell you how the Afghan military and the Afghan civilian leaders trickled down this information, basically. But he said, what I can say is that there was a deliberate handover, and that within 48 hours, around 48 hours before the U.S. vacated this base, there was even a walkthrough of the base. So in his view, and in the Pentagon's view, the Afghans were very aware of what was happening. There's been a couple of other things that we're looking into as well. We were told that the electricity went out once the U.S. left. Apparently, it looks like some of the generators were shut off when the Americans left. We're trying to figure out how this happened. Was this an oversight as well? Did no one explain how to keep the generators running? Was this intentional? There are still a lot of questions that need to be answered. But the biggest question was, why were the Afghans not more prepared for this? And why did the U.S. not feel like it could share full details about when they were leaving Bagram? And Pentagon Press Secretary John Kirby told me and other reporters that basically this was operational security, and that while it wasn't a contested withdrawal, they had to prepare as if the Taliban could find out and could try to attack.
Carla Babb is VOA's Pentagon correspondent, speaking with VOA's Steve Miller. Coming up on VOA Asia, more COVID vaccine will go from the U.S. to two more countries, but is it enough? Happening now in Asia, South Korean Prime Minister Kim Buk-yeom said the government can impose the strongest social distancing measures amid a current record-high surge in COVID-19 cases. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We are happy you're with us on VOA Asia. The Biden administration announced shipments of millions of Moderna vaccine donations for Vietnam and Guatemala Tuesday, after pledging to donate 4 million doses to Indonesia last week. But overall, the U.S. fell short of its target of sending 80 million doses to countries in need by the end of June. White House correspondent Patsy Wunikuswara has this report on the challenges facing the U.S. effort to help vaccinate the world.
Two countries will receive U.S. vaccine donations this week, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said on Tuesday.
Both Guatemala and Vietnam will be receiving COVID vaccine doses from the Biden-Harris administration. Guatemala will receive 1.5 million doses of Moderna, and Vietnam will receive 2 million doses of Moderna.
As Indonesians brace for a surge in cases and lined up for their shots, last week the Biden administration also promised the country 4 million doses of the Moderna vaccine to be shipped via COVAX, the UN mechanism for vaccine sharing, as soon as possible. The U.S. has committed to donating 580 million doses worldwide, but it has failed to meet its target of sending out 80 million doses by the end of June. Psaki told VOA there are huge challenges.
Sometimes we have to work through legal barriers. We have to work through regulatory barriers. There are issues as it relates to materials needed to distribute these vaccines. And there are also even transportation issues with refrigeration needed as well. So we have noted, as even as we've allocated all these doses, as we committed to, that part of it is countries need to be ready to receive them.
The challenge begins with determining the appropriate vaccine. Most of the U.S. available stockpile consists of Pfizer and Moderna, which require ultra-cold storage that not all countries are prepared to handle. Krishna Udayakumar is the founding director of the Duke Global Health Innovation Center.
Once they get there, we have to know what's the expiration date on the batches that we're sending. We have to know at the country level whether there's regulatory authorization for that particular vaccine to be used and that particular batch to be imported. And that's just really the beginning. We then have to make sure that the vaccines can get in cold storage all the way to the last mile, that the workforce is ready and the vaccinators are trained, and that they can get out.
Recipient countries must also coordinate the different vaccines they're getting from other providers, including COVAX, China, and Russia, which requires a lot of planning and complicated supply chain management. Again, Duke University's Krishna Udayakumar.
It shouldn't be a surprise that shipping vaccines is complicated from a logistics perspective, and we are behind. We should have been working on this 6 months ago.
There's also the fact that most of the vaccine doses are simply going to wealthy nations.
By the end of this week, we'll have reached the mark of 160 million fully vaccinated Americans.
CEO of the One Campaign, Tom Hart.
We have locked up in the United States and the G7 and other EU countries the global supply of the very thing to end this pandemic. And so far not sharing at nearly the pace or scale that we need to reach what's the global herd immunity that will make all of us safe.
So far, the U.S. has shipped only about half of the 80 million doses it aimed to distribute by end of June. At the White House, Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News.
When Malaysian mother Hantija Niamat was struggling to cope during the coronavirus lockdown, she hung a scrap of white cloth outside of her window in a plea for help. Olivia Chan reports what happened.
In a cluster of residential flats in Petaling Jaya, Malaysia, 73-year-old Hantija Niamat hung a scrap of white cloth outside her window in a desperate call for help amid the country's strict lockdown. Shortly after, neighbours came by to offer her food and other items. The hashtag Bendera Putih, or White Flag campaign, has gained momentum on social media in a bid to encourage people to help others in distress during a prolonged lockdown.
I put up a large white flag, and not even a few minutes after, some neighbours came with rice and things. I thought it would be outsiders who would come to help, like wealthy people or ministers or important people. But they said, we're neighbors. If someone puts up a white flag, of course we need to be concerned. I was stunned.
Hadija's husband has a disability and lost his job last year. Since then, the family has to ration their food. They are among many low-income families in Malaysia that have been struggling since the country was put under a nationwide lockdown on June the 1st. In response to the White Flag campaign, businesses, politicians and celebrities have stepped in to donate. This is lawmaker Maria Chin Abdullah.
It's something that this country actually needs, yeah? Because we can't cover everybody. So it's good that, you know, you indicate you need help and we'll come to you.
Malaysia has reported more than 755,000 cases of COVID-19, the third highest tally in Southeast Asia.
Reuters' Olivia Chan reporting. Authorities locked down a Chinese city bordering Myanmar Wednesday, shutting most businesses and requiring residents to stay at home as a fresh outbreak of COVID-19 expanded. Another 15 cases were found in Ruili in the past 24 hours, on top of 6 in the previous 2 days, according to state broadcaster CCTV. In addition, 2 people without COVID-19 symptoms also have tested positive for the virus. CCTV adds businesses and public institutions are closed except for hospitals, pharmacies, and essential shops like grocery stores. And the mayor in southwest Missouri, who imposed a face mask requirement during the height of the pandemic, is now facing a recall vote. AP correspondent Jackie Quinn reports.
The mask mandate was imposed last October and lifted in April, but Nix's mayor, Brian Steele, might still face voter outrage in November. The Springfield News-Ledger reports there are enough petition signatures to force a recall vote November 2nd. The petition claims Steele took actions detrimental to the city, its economy, and the health and welfare of the community in general by having them wear masks during a pandemic. Nix is about 10 miles south of Springfield, where hospitals are again overflowing with COVID patients. That's because of the Delta variant and low vaccination rates. I'm Jackie Quinn.
You can read and see more on these stories at VOA Asia Facebook.
VOA Asia Facebook is the choice of millions to see and read the latest stories about Asia and the United States. Follow us on VOA Asia Facebook and say hello anytime you're online or on your smartphone. VOA Asia is also on Twitter and YouTube. Subscribe to all of our platforms for free. See, hear, read, and share all the latest from VOA Asia anytime.
This news from VOA Asia. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken Tuesday met Uyghur survivors of internment camps in China's Xinjiang region in a visit aimed at highlighting Beijing's alleged genocide against the Muslim minority group. All of the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Twitter and Facebook. This is VOA Asia. This is Business Scene. I'm Ira Melman. Squatting in the dust by the main road to Afghanistan's biggest airbase, Mir Salam sifts through a pile of broken electronics in front of him, salvaged from departing U.S. troops. All around are heaps of junk and scrapped equipment, ranging from telephones and thermos flasks to computer keyboards and printer cartridges. The Pentagon is vacating Bagram Air Base as part of its plan to withdraw all forces by this year's 20th anniversary of the September 11th attacks on the United States, and it could be completed by the end of the month. Military gear is being taken home or given to Afghan security forces, but tons of civilian equipment must be left behind. The result is a booming scrap business that is making money for some, but leaving many resentful. Scrap warehouse owner Mir Salam.
Instead of destroying all these materials, they should have left them intact and given them to the public or the government. The government could make use of it. Unfortunately, our government is also corrupt. If they had used it properly, then they could have rebuilt our country 10 times.
Salam pays 1,000 Afghanis, equal to $12 a month, to rent a modest fence plot on the Bagram Road, where he stores base scrap that he searches for nuggets to sell to specialized dealers. The big players have contracts to remove the scrap equipment, which they cherry-pick for items that can be repaired. Anything they don't use is left for smaller dealers, such as Salam. Stepping into Tony Lai and Maggie Chan's studio is like walking into a time machine, if that time machine also shrunk everything around except yourself. In one corner, an entire fairground is laid out, complete with moving rides and a revolving Ferris wheel. On the other side, a tiny reenactment of the city's Fire Dragon Festival is underway. Elsewhere is a meticulously recreated revolving restaurant and an entire housing block, complete with window laundry and the fast-disappearing neon signs that once lit up Hong Kong streets with kaleidoscopic abandon. The two artists share a common passion in bringing their childhood scenes back to life and say that Hong Kongers are keen to glimpse into the past or recapture faded memories. Tony Lai is the co-owner of Toma Miniatures.
At the end of the day, Hong Kong is a big city, so there's lots of architecture or things from our childhood that have disappeared one by one. If we can use our abilities with miniature models as a way to recreate these, then it is a happy thing.
Preserving the past is difficult in Hong Kong. Historical buildings are often pitted against powerful billionaire real estate developers and government planners who are eager to build more high-rise apartment blocks in a city where housing is in desperately short supply. For Business Scene, I'm Ira Melman. Making headlines in Asia, Sri Lanka Wednesday issued its most expensive gold coin ever to celebrate the 100th anniversary of the Chinese Communist Party, underscoring the close ties between the countries. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. Former U.S. President Jimmy Carter and his wife, former First Lady Rosalynn Carter, celebrated their 75th wedding anniversary Wednesday. VOA's Kane Farabaugh reports on some of the secrets behind the partnership of the longest married presidential couple in U.S. history.
Jimmy Carter admits when he was 21 years old, marrying his sweetheart, Rosalynn Smith, then 18 years old, was not a sure thing.
When I asked Rosalynn to marry me the first time, she said no.
But persistence paid off, and the couple wed on July 7, 1946, in their hometown of Plains, Georgia. 75 years later, the former president says one of the secrets to their long and successful marriage is space.
And so we've had a kind of a policy there on which we agreed. We give each other plenty of space to do our own things, and we try to find things that we'd like to do together, and we concentrate on them.
Carter says while this strategy doesn't always prevent disagreements, it's helped keep them short.
We get angry often, but we try to get over it before we go to sleep.
Jimmy and Rosalynn Carter have the most successful partnership in the history of the American presidency.
Jonathan Alter is the author of his very best, Jimmy Carter, A Life.
And Rosalynn is the more shrewd of the two politically.
Kane Farabaugh, VOA News, Plains, Georgia.
Linda Reyes of Los Angeles, California, loves riding her Harley-Davidson motorcycle. She eventually started a nonprofit group called Biker Chicks and dreams of becoming a professional motorcycle mechanic. Gina Dulow spoke with Reyes and other women who share her passion for motorcycles.
It's been 15 years since Lydia Reyes completed her motorcycle riding classes with distinction. She says for her, riding a motorcycle feels liberating.
You have a machine that you're in total control of, and this machine can do powerful things, and you have control of it. You just sit on it and take it for a ride, and you have the power to slow it down. You have the power to throttle all the way through. It's an amazing freedom.
Jenny Adulu for VOA News, Los Angeles, California.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. Like us on Facebook, VOA Asia. Follow us on Twitter at VOA Asia. Thanks for joining us. Thanks to our service chief, Diane Gao. Our VOA Asia team includes Doug Bernard, Keith Lane, Amy Heibels, Chris Cascao, and Jim Stevenson. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Stay safe and enjoy the day ahead.